This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals only. Welcome to the Oncology Knowledge into Practice podcast, where we discuss game-changing topics in clinical oncology with leading experts in the field. In this series, we're focusing on the ever-changing treatment landscape for cancers of the hematological system. This series is supported by educational grants from Servier Pharmaceuticals LLC and Takeda, who have had no influence on the content or choice of faculty. If you'd like to check out any of the publications that we mention in this episode, there's references and links for these in the episode notes. We're your hosts, Hannah Wilgar
and Andre Grasa. Last week, we spoke about the mechanism of action and proposed role of NAE inhibitors in treating patients with high-risk myelodysplastic syndrome. Treatment strategies vary greatly for MDS patients depending on their prognosis. And in this episode, we're going to delve a little deeper into the process of elucidating a patient's risk level.
Today, we welcome Professor Detlef Haas to answer our questions on this topic. Dr. Haas is Medical Director of the Special Diagnostic Laboratories at the Clinic for Hematology and Medical Oncology at the University Medical Center in Göttingen, Germany. As always, to get started, we're going to spend a few minutes discussing the basics. But if you're already familiar with risk stratification for myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, do feel free to skip ahead to the interview at the 5-minute mark. As discussed in the previous episodes, after a diagnosis of MDS has been made, there are several steps to identifying the patient's particular subclass of MDS, which in turn will influence the best choice of therapy. According to ESMO and NCCN guidelines, the first of these stratification steps is classifying the patient depending on their risk of AML development and short survival. This is important because for patients with a better prognosis, treatments can simply focus on alleviating the symptoms of their cytopenias with therapies such as erythropoiesis stimulating agents, also called ESAs, and antibiotics. However, for those with a poorer prognosis and a higher risk of developing AML, treatment strategies should usually be more geared towards actually modifying the disease course and prolonging survival. For these patients, more aggressive treatments, including allogeneic stem cell therapy and chemotherapy, should be considered.
The most commonly accepted system for stratifying MDS patients by risk level is the Revised International Prognostic Scoring System, also known as the IPSS-R, which was developed by Greenberg and colleagues in 2012. The IPSS-R is based on a statistical study of over 7,000 untreated MDS patients from multiple institutional databases, which looked at how much certain clinical features correlated with survival and progression to AML. In their analysis, the authors found that five factors appear to contribute to a patient's risk of AML development or death more than others. These were bone marrow blasts, hemoglobin levels, platelet levels, absolute neutrophil count, or ANC, and cytogenetic abnormalities.
Most of these factors influenced survival on a spectrum, but to consider the extent of their findings, let's take the extremes of two of their five factors. For bone marrow blasts, according to Greenberg's analysis, a bone marrow with 0-2% blasts was associated with 5.9 years median survival at one end of the scale, whereas those with 20-30% blasts at the other end of the scale had just a 1.4-year medium survival chance. While not so easily quantifiable, different cytogenetic abnormalities were also associated with distinctly different prognoses, and so Greenberg and colleagues categorised these accordingly. Abnormalities in the very good category, for example a deletion in the long arm of chromosome 11, were associated with a medium survival of 5.4 years, while the presence of more than three abnormalities encompasses the very poor category, which is associated with a medium survival of just 0.7 years.
Greenberg and colleagues used the five factors they had identified to create the IPSS-R scoring system, whereby a patient is given a score for each of their results for five prognostic categories. To use the scoring system, you must measure a patient's bone marrow blasts, hemoglobin levels, platelet levels, absolute neutrophil count, or ANC, and cytogenetic abnormalities, and compare the results to Greenberg's score value table. To give some examples, once again looking at extremes, a cytogenetic profile in the very good category gives a score of 0, while a very poor cytogenetic profile gives a score of 4. Bone marrow blasts below 2% give a score of 0, while greater than 10% give a score of 3.
For hemoglobin levels, those with 10 or more grams per deciliter are given a score of 0, while those with less than 8 have a score of 1.5. Those with platelet levels of 100 billion per litre or more get a score of 0, while those with less than 50 billion per litre get a score of 1. And those with ANC above and below 0.8 billion per litre receive a score of 0 and 0.5, respectively.
Once you have identified the patient's score for each category, calculate the sum of scores to generate the patient's overall risk category. A total score of 1.5 or less is very low risk. 1.5 to 3 is low. 3 to 4.5 is intermediate. 4.5 to 6 is high. And 6 or above is very high. When Greenberg's team applied the scoring system to the same database of patients, those in the very low risk category had a median survival of 8.8 years, whereas those in the very high risk category had a median overall survival of only 0.8 years.
Greenberg's IPSSR and its predecessor, the IPSS system, have both since been used to select patients who will benefit most from novel drugs in clinical trials. And so drug indications also tend to specify if the drug is intended for high or low risk patients. Risk stratification is therefore imperative when using these drugs to achieve the prescribed benefit. The earlier IPSS system was historically used in trials and in the clinic, but this system is based on only 816 patients instead of 7,012, and it's less specific, so the IPSSR system is most recommended. Another scoring system used less often is the WHO classification-based prognostic scoring system, or WPSS, which assesses the presence of severe anemia, the MDS subtype, and cytogenetics. As discussed previously, it is important to assess a patient's risk because their risk category will influence their therapy options. For patients that fall into the higher risk category, ESMO and NCCN guidelines stipulate that allogeneic stem cell therapy should be given first line to patients who are fit enough with an available stem cell donor, though whether these patients should be pretreated with chemotherapy or hypomethylating agents is a topic of debate. For those who are older, less fit, or lacking a suitable donor, these patients should be treated with a hypomethylating agent such as azacitidine or with chemotherapy. Extremely frail patients should receive the best supportive care. Clinical trials also usually stipulate a risk category, and so recruitment onto clinical trials and treatment with novel therapies will also be dependent on risk.
A number of questions remain about the use of risk stratification systems in MDS patients. For example, while risk scores can predict prognosis, can their use and subsequently individualized treatment improve outcomes? Should patients have their risk levels reassessed throughout treatment? And what about other factors that influence risk, such as age and ECOG performance?
To answer some of these today, we have Professor Detlef Haas, Medical Director of the Special Diagnostic Laboratories at the Clinic for Hematology and Medical Oncology at the University Medical Center in Göttingen, Germany. So thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation to give this interview.
So, what evidence is there that stratifying patients based on risk level before deciding on treatment leads to better outcomes for both high and low risk groups?
Yes, to start this, let me develop a picture. I would say that clinical management without risk stratification is a bit like sailing over the ocean without a compass, or to be up to date, without a GPS system. So risk stratification provides surely a more objective basis for therapy decisions and basic parameters such as blood counts and blast percentages are not enough. One example, we have several cases with RARS, which normally mean very low risk MDS subtypes. However, in several of these patients, maybe 10 to 15%, we could identify complex chromosome abnormalities, and this totally changes the prognostic profile of these patients. And a very good example, I guess, for the relevance of risk stratification for clinical decision making is a famous Cutler paper on allogeneic stem cell transplantation. And I don't want to go into detail of this paper, but this means that you can be too early or too late. And thus one has to find the best time point for the right therapy. Especially in elder patients, the aim of curation even may be unrealistic, thus slowing down progression and achieving best possible quality of life could also be a very good alternative goal for therapy or goal for the clinical management. And that can mean that starting with best supportive care, followed by ESAs or luspatercept, demethylating agents, new combinations, and so on, could be the sequence which can develop over several years. So risk stratification is extremely important. And it also directly impacts on the availability of drugs such as demethylating agents only for higher risk patients, MDS patients, at least in Europe. So I guess it is really obvious and clear that risk stratification is a very important tool to improve patient management.
Brilliant, thank you. So should patients have their IPSS scores reassessed at certain intervals to identify if their risk category and therefore choice of therapy has changed?
To my opinion, it makes sense since MDS are very dynamic diseases and the biology of MDS and thus the entire character of the disease will change over time. On the other hand, IPSSR was not statistically verified for a reuse during the course of the disease, especially concerning overall survival and time to AML progression. However, reassessment will provide valuable and more objective information whether MDS is progressing or not. So it is clear that initially, IPSSR was developed only for an initial risk stratification, but it is a valuable tool to stay informed about whether the character of the disease changes over time. And we have data from our lab and from some research project that, to give you an impression, the estimated annual genetic evolution rate in MDS amounts to 15 to 20% per year. So that means that, or that underlines the fact how dynamic MDS diseases are and that this dynamics has to be controlled by us if we are treating patients with MDS. And maybe most of you know that there are very much new promising agents under investigation for relapsed or refractory MDS after demethylating agents such as venetoclax, new checkpoint inhibitors, TIM inhibitors, or anti-CD47 monoclonal antibodies, pevonedistat, and so on. And to decide to give these new drugs in future will mainly depend on how good we are informed about the actual character of the MDS. This also refers to new drugs for lower risk transfusion-dependent MDS patients like luspatercept, where we have a clear association with the SS3B1 mutations and the ring sideroblastic phenotype, as well as for imetelstat, new telomerase inhibitor. So again, we need to re-investigate and to reassess not only IPSSR, but also very important genetics, which also refers to a further very promising drug, APR246, a reactivator of mutated TP53. And we now learn a lot about also dynamics of TP53 alterations. It is now clear that, for instance, in cases with isolated 5q deletion, which is a quite good and for the first years, let's say, quite harmless abnormality. However, some 20% of these patients very early harbor also P53 mutations, but in a very low frequency of cells. And it can last over several years until this P53 mutated subclone becomes dominant. And if you don't control this, you will miss the point where such a clone becomes dominant and needs specific therapy. I'm aware of the fact that this drug is not available as yet, but it is examined in several trials, even phase 3 trials, and I would expect that there will be a fast licensing in of this substance because it addresses unmet medical need. I guess all of you are familiar with this, the fact that P53 mutations, at least when two alleles of P53 are altered, alterated, means a very bad prognosis. And due to the high average age of MDS patients, a lot of these patients are not eligible for allogeneic stem cell transplantation.
Brilliant, thank you. So should clinicians incorporate additional factors into their risk assessments, such as age, ECOG performance, prior treatment or somatic mutations? And if so, when?
Yes, it's also a very obvious question to start with the time point. It depends a bit on the aim we have concerning therapy. I would say if you have a quite old patient who have a very low risk MDS, that would mean that you can perform clinical surveillance every 6 months or so. If you have patients where you are more ambitious concerning therapy, and the most ambition I would have if this patient is therapeutically able to be transplanted, I would say that such patients should be seen at least every 3 months. And a good tool to get a certain survey with low costs is to perform blood counts. And this also depends on how advanced the MDS is and how your therapeutic goal looks like. This can be that you need blood counts once a week, especially in patients with high transfusion need, or only every 4 months and so. We hand out a so-called therapy pass to our patients, and there the values can be documented. And if they come back to us into our day clinics, we can get a very fast overview about the development of the blood values over the last weeks. And this is a very good and cheap method to survey these patients. All the parameters you named are valuable, surely. Concerning molecular mutations, everybody now at the moment is waiting for the IPSSR molecular. This will come, but it needs time because it's extremely complicated and because we have, in a certain way, two dimensions. On the one hand, we have molecular mutations. On the other hand, we have cytogenetics. And so these different dimensions influence each other, and this is very hard to calculate this out by statistical means. But the IPSS molecular will come, and I guess in future this will be another important additional factor to improve patient care. And maybe most of you are familiar with the very recent data concerning the mutational status of p53. This is the most clear result of the activities concerning the development of the IPSSR molecular, which say that if you have one intact wild type allele, the prognosis of p53 is not worse as compared to patients who have a completely intact p53 gene. However, in patients where both alleles are affected, the prognosis is extremely poor. So that is, let's say, the beginning of the new IPSSR molecular.
Brilliant, thank you. So do you have any other words of wisdom for our clinicians when stratifying their MDS patients based on risk in the clinic?
Yes, I would again emphasize that risk estimation has to be redone. And this re-estimation of risk also not only is mainly influenced by genetics, but also by response to antecedent therapy. Let's say a big unmet medical need all are familiar with is what happens if patients become resistant or don't respond to demethylating agents. And there are now several interesting new agents. It is quite obvious that demethylating agents still will remain the backbone. And substances like TIM inhibitors or anti-CD47 monoclonal antibodies, pevonedistat, venetoclax, and so on, will be combined with this backbone. And maybe in future, it will also become important to redo cytogenetic and molecular genetic, which, by the way, is clearly recommended by the WHO classification and by ALN guidelines to show whether new targets for new therapies pop up during the course of the disease, maybe as part of a certain process which refers resistance to an antecedent therapy.
So thank you for joining us today.
Yes, you're welcome. It was a pleasure for me, and all the best to you. Take care and stay healthy in these hard times.
So that brings us to the end of today's episode. To recap on the key points we discussed, several lines of evidence demonstrate the value of risk stratification for improving outcomes in MDS. This can be done with tools such as the IPSSR, or in the future, the IPSS molecular, which incorporates additional characteristics, and clinicians should also reassess their patients throughout their treatment journey in order to keep informed about progression and the best choice of therapy. Again, if you'd like to check out any of the publications that we've mentioned today, you'll find references for these in the episode notes. If you enjoyed today, please do subscribe and join us for our next episode. And if you have time to leave us a review, we'd love to hear your feedback. If you want more, you can also find free accredited continuing medical education modules on our website, onkip.com, and you can find a link to this in the episode notes, so please do check it out. If you're a Twitter fan, our handle is @onkip. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again soon.